people. Looks like a lot of people out there. I am Barbara Parmley, a very grateful Al-Anon. Thank you for the beautiful flowers, Bonnie, and the nice introduction. I was talking to Charlie the other day, and I said, I just can't believe that somebody in Denver or Greeley would pay my expenses to come all this way to tell you what it used to be like, you know, and, you know, how I'm able to be where I am today and be comfortable with my life today. I still have a hard time believing that this, you know, that somebody wants to hear me talk. And I didn't know I had an accent. And I heard a tape one time. I played this tape back that they had sent me of a talk I'd made somewhere, and I turned that tape on, and I thought, well, they've sent the wrong tape. That isn't me. That sounds like Minnie Pearl. And I told Charlie, I said, Charlie, do I really sound like this? And he said, well, yes. I said, you sound like you, but that sounds like Minnie Pearl. And I'm so embarrassed. I do. I have an Arkansas whang tang, whatever, you know. But, and I guess we don't know how we sound. It's kind of like the way I used to live. I didn't know how I used to act either. I'm here because my life was affected by alcoholism. My behavior when I came into this alcoholic marriage was already becoming a little erratic. I look back over my life, and I think we're all born with certain traits. And I was the oldest of three girls in our family. And it just seemed somewhere, and maybe my folks did tell me, that I was responsible for my younger sisters. Anyway, I always felt this way. And when I was in about the third grade, my mother left the family. She decided she wanted to leave and left my father and these two younger sisters. And then I felt like I was supposed to take care of Daddy, you know, and my younger sisters. And I remember feeling so sorry for my sisters and for my father because he didn't have a wife. And we had to spend a period of, about a year in a children's home because of the war at that time. And there wasn't anyone to take care of the younger children. And my father did work nights. So we were in this children's home, and I remember feeling so sorry for my daddy, you know, not having a wife or children at home with him. We all had to be over at this other place, and my little sister's not having a mother. And I just, you know, I just ate this up. I mean, it never occurred to me that I didn't have a mother, you know, because I guess I just fell right into place. And I couldn't wait until I could grow up and get married and play house. And I can remember as a child, I always wanted to play house, you know, and I just idolized my father. And he was the good father. He you know, we were first. I felt like he put us first. He spent a lot of time with us. He played with us. And I remember when I was sick, it was Daddy that was there, you know, took care of us. And so I wanted a man like my father. And I thought that when you got married, this would be the kind of husband you would have. And so I couldn't wait to get old, you know, to grow up and get married. Well, he told me I couldn't. Of course, when I was 12, I'd gotten married if they'd let me. You know, if I could have found someone. And my daddy told me that you can't get married until you graduate from high school. So I graduated from high school in May, and in August I got married. I got engaged on my graduation. I just couldn't wait, you know. So I finally convinced this young man that I'd make a good wife and we could get married and start playing house. Besides, there were some things I wanted to do that my daddy told me I couldn't do till I got married, so I couldn't wait to get married to do it. That was back in those days when, you know, things were a little different than they are now, you know, and you just didn't do that till you got married. So I got married and was disappointed. You know, it was just downhill from there on, you know. After we've been married about 2 years, we did have a child, and of course I liked the role as the mother. But this husband just did not play house like my daddy did, you know. He was so busy doing a lot of other things, and he just didn't seem to have time for me and the children. And we did end up with three children, and I never could get this fella to play house. He just, you know, I had these little rules, and this is what he does, and this is what mommy does, and, you know, this is what the family does. And he just would refuse to obey these rules. So I thought, well, I'm wasting time here. I've got three children already, you know, with this man, and if I'm going to find another one that's going to play house right, I better get on with it, you know. So we got a divorce, and I set out to find the perfect husband and father for my children. And I thought, now I want someone who will love my children, because I wanted to be a daddy like my daddy was. And I want a man who will be financially secure so I don't have to work, because I'd always worked prior to this time. And I want somebody that could take care of me financially. And I want someone who would want me for the hobby. This other fellow, he was just too busy with all his hobbies to have time for me. So I wanted someone who wanted me for a hobby. What I was looking for, really, was a rich sex maniac. So I had gone off to this state agency that I worked for, had a meeting in Oklahoma City at this time, and I met a gentleman who had a job related to the agency that I worked for, and I had written letters to this gentleman for my boss several times, this Mr. Charles Parmley, and I assumed he was an elderly gentleman, about like he is now. This was about 19 years ago. So at this table that we were sitting at this convention, they introduced me to Charles Parmley, and he just looked like the nicest man. He was so quiet and smiled. He just looked like a real sweet person. Of course, and I knew he had a good job, so that was one for him right there, you know. So we did get acquainted, and I really began to like this gentleman. And he loved my children. He'd been married before, but he'd never had any children. And he just fell in love with my children, and they liked him. And I thought, you know, now he did drink a lot. That was what I could not quite understand. That I just thought, boy, that guy's thirsty. You know, I just wherever we went, he always had this bottle in the glove compartment. It was strange things that he drank. I remember he had peppermint schnapps. I'd never heard of peppermint schnapps. Well, I'm naive about alcohol. Back when I was growing up, maybe once in a while on New Year's Eve, the family would have a party, and there'd be some friends there, and the folks would have a bottle of alcohol and mixed drinks, you know. And then, of course, as I graduated from high school, and we would go out sometimes on Saturday night if you had an extra $10 to spend on a few drinks, and we partied. So drinking, to me, was when you go to the bar so you can dance, and you had to drink to be there to dance, you know. But this fella, he carries this stuff around the glove box and in the trunk, and you know, we didn't do anything without this drink. But he was always so nice, and he never was drunk. And like I said, I loved to go to where they danced. And, of course, if you have to drink there to dance, well, that was fine. And Charlie could drink all night and still dance. And he was just my idea of a fun guy, you know. So I thought, well, I did mention his drinking one time to him. We were going somewhere, and he asked me to get this bottle out of the glove box, and he could just tip it up. And I know I have drank mixed drinks, but I never did like much of the alcohol. And I kind of like the mixer better than the alcohol, because the alcohol has a bad taste. And so I couldn't understand how he could drink that straight and it didn't burn his throat, you know, and he didn't choke or anything. I said, Charlie, how do you drink that alcohol straight like that? And he says, now, Barbara, that's one of the things I like about you, is that you don't ever say anything about my drinking. And now, this was before we got married, so I thought, now, if I want to catch this guy, you just cool that, and we'll straighten that out after we get married. You know, if you love them enough, they won't need that alcohol. You know, I'll be the answer to all of his problems. So we did get married, and before we got married, he told me that he had this land in Arkansas, around the Arkansas-Oklahoma line. We were living in Tulsa then, and he said, now, I'll build us a home over there on the Maysville, Arkansas line, and we'll just live in the country. That's a good place to raise these children. And he said, I won't have to drink so much either, because the responsibility of this job, and he did have a very responsible job with a lot of stress in it. He said, and when I get away from that job, I won't have to drink so much. And I thought, well, that's good, because it was, you know, it used to take us from Tulsa, Oklahoma, to where we live. It's about a 2-hour drive, and it would take us 3, because he would stop at every beer joint. From Tulsa to Maysville, you know, you stop at one for beer, and the next one you stop to relieve the beer, you know. So I thought, well, maybe we'd get there faster if I bought some beer, and we could, you know, he could drink that on the way, and we wouldn't have to stop, because here I had these 3 kids and the dog and his mother, and we'd head for Maysville every weekend while we were building this house and all, you know. And so anyway, we did get married, and we moved to the farm, but the drinking didn't get better. All of a sudden, Charlie was getting drunk. And I had never even seen him drunk. And this was a different drunk than I'd seen drunks. Because I'd seen kids, you know, people get drunk when we'd be out partying and they just get silly. Charlie just got weird. You know, he just went out. And I thought, I what's happening, you know? And there would be times when he would go to feed the pigs and, you know, he wouldn't come back for 2 days. And And I would be angry, you know, and I'd meet him at the door and I'd call him all these names and I would accuse him of all these things. And mainly I was concerned about who he was drinking with. You know, I was really relieved when I came into Al-Anon and found out that alcohol was the problem, not this other thing, you know. Because I just figured I was going to be replaced, maybe, or something, you know. And, you know, when you're number two wife, you figure you can always be replaced. So, it was getting pretty bad, you know. He would disappear, and I would get crazy. And by that time, he and I had a child between us, and there I was with four children on this farm. And see, we were raising 45,000 chickens, and we had about 20 sows that were always all pigging at once. And I've lost track of how many head of cattle we'd have, and they'd be calving, and Charlie would disappear, you know. And he'd come in, and I'd give him what for, and I'd say, "Why do you leave me here with all of this?" He says, "Ah, I knew you could handle it." Yeah. So I guess I can handle it. So I go about feeding the chickens or doing whatever I need to do, and as he says, I didn't do too good a job, but I worked at it. And then he'd tell me, you know, "I want to be the boss. By God, I'll take care of this, you know." And so then, oh, that's right. Now he's sober and he's home today. He's boss. Now, when he leaves, then I get to be boss, you know. And I was having a trouble, you know, trying to remember when I was boss and when I wasn't, you know, trying to play the role of, you know. And then I think, now, what did I do last time that made him disappear? Now, I won't do that again, you know. So we begin to play different roles, you know, and I begin to write things on the calendar. Mainly I was concerned about who he was disappearing with. So I thought, if I can find out how many miles he drives, then I can figure out who she is. And, you know, I know where she lives. So I would keep the mileage, and we had three vehicles. And my calendar was covered with all these mileages, you know. And as soon as he'd come in, I'd run out and check the mileage, and I'd start driving in all directions, you know, and try to find out who she was. I remember I would call, and where we live is very rural, and there weren't too many people that we knew anyway, but I would call what families I knew, the ladies I knew that might be interested in my husband. I thought everybody loved my Charlie, you know, because he was a sex maniac, you know. So I would call my friends, and maybe it'd be 11 or 12 at night, and I'd call all these ladies' houses, and of course it was kind of embarrassing when they answered, because then I'd have to figure out, you know, some excuse why I was calling them, and I would ask them about a recipe or some dumb thing I'd make up, you know. It kept you on your toes trying to keep up with these alcoholics, all these excuses we made. And we do all this sober. You know, an alcoholic gets drunk and he has to make up all these excuses, but we Al-Anons, we do all this stone cold sober, you know. And, of course, if one of them wasn't home, she was it. You know, that's who it was. Whereas when I came into Al-Anon, I had to make amends to a lot of these ladies for my thinking. You know, I couldn't go until I tell them, you know, I thought you were running around my husband or something, but I did in my own way let them know that I was pretty squirrely, you know, there for a period of time, and I appreciated them putting up with me. But things did get worse and worse and worse, and finally toward the last, I thought, well, I've had it, you know, and I couldn't find a job. This was a rural area, and I'd always worked before secretarial work, but I couldn't find a job, and so I couldn't leave him. I couldn't go home with four children, and so I decided that I would just file for divorce, and I guess go on welfare, whatever, you know. So I went to the attorney and filed for divorce, and I came home and I told Charlie, I said, "You're going to have to leave." You know, I filed for divorce, and of course, he talked me out of it. He promised me to quit drinking, and that's all I wanted to hear. You know, I just wanted him to stop drinking. I really didn't want to get rid of Charlie. I just wanted to get rid of this problem. So he said the magic words, you know, "I'll quit drinking," and he did, you know, for a while. And of course, an alcoholic doesn't quit drinking for long. So he started drinking again, and it got bad. So I decided I'd file for divorce again. It worked once. Try it again. It's expensive, but it worked. You know, I spent more on lawyers than Charlie did on the alcohol. The thing that was always so The thing that was so frustrating was that when I'd go up to file for this divorce, of course you got it. They want to know what you want out of course. And these lawyers, they always want the woman to take everything. I found that out with my first divorce. But I'm so sweet and nice. I don't want anything that I didn't help pay for. So I thought, well, I didn't. This home, everything was Charlie's. In fact, it was not till after he got sober they even put my name on anything. I can't understand that. Not that I was a little insane, but he wanted to know what I wanted. You know, I said, well, I need a home for the children I live in. I'll just take the house, and he can have all this land and everything else, you know, and the car that I had when I married him, and my furniture. So then he said, well, how much land is the house on? And I said, well, I don't know, you know. He said, well, I need to have dimensions, you know, to put in this contract for the divorce. So I'd go home with my yardstick, and I guess it was probably a half an acre. I don't know. It was a long ways to go with the yardstick. I never did get around it. About the time I'd count off about 15 yardsticks, one of the kids would ask me something, I'd forget. And I didn't want Charlie to catch me measuring it, because then he'd know what I was going to do, and he might do something to me, you know. And because he threatened one time that he'd burn it down before he let me have it, and I believed him. So anyway, I never did get that place measured. But anyway, here I am this time, and I'm going back for the second divorce, and I'm too embarrassed to go to this same lawyer that I went to before, because I'd called him up and told him we'd worked it out, and here I am two or three months later, and I'm wanting another one. I don't want to think there's something wrong with me, you know. And so I went to the second lawyer, and I told him that I wanted to file for divorce. I wanted to put in the paper. I always wanted to put in the paper. I was hoping people back in Tulsa would read this paper and find out what a no-good SOB Charlie really was. You know, that he was a drunk. And I said, I want it in there. I'm divorcing him for drunkenness. Not incompatibility, but drunkenness. So we go through the formalities of this, and I go home, and I tell Charlie again, you know, I'm filing for a divorce. And he promised me he'd quit. And I said, okay. So I called the lawyer, and I said, well, we're going to work this out, drop the proceedings. So, of course, he didn't stay sober long. And I went to... I had a sister visiting me from Tulsa, and she brought me some literature because she knew there's some problem in the home. And she brought me Al-Anon literature, and she brought AA literature. And I read the Al-Anon literature, and I really just... That just didn't make sense to me. It said to leave them alone, you know, get off their back. And I thought, no, you don't get people to quit something by getting off their back. He'll think I like... You know, it's like saying it's okay. And it wasn't okay. You know, I want him to stop. And when you want somebody to stop, you make them stop. And so I just didn't buy that. I said, what he really wants is a nurse. You know, and I'm no nurse. So, but I read the AA literature, and I could see Charlie all right. He was an alcoholic. There was no doubt about that. So I set it aside. And things kept getting worse and worse. And finally, I got to the point where I could tell there was something a little bit wrong with my behavior. You know, I was so angry all the time. I could hear it in my voice with the children. I was taking it out on the kids, and their father threatened that if there's any more problems in that home with this drinking, that he was going to take these children. And I always said, because I did, my mother left me when I was young, that, you know, there was no way that anyone would ever take my children from me, or I would ever leave them. That would be one thing that I would always see to, you know, that there was no man or nothing more important to me than my children. And so I was beginning to get panicky. You know, I thought, what am I going to have to do? And I couldn't seem to leave Charlie. And I didn't want him, but I didn't want anybody else to have him. And I finally thought, I'll just have to get rid of him. You know, next time he comes in that pickup and passes out, I'll asphyxiate him. And it just made such good sense to me, and I knew I could probably do it and get by with it. And then I thought, Barbara, you're really getting sick. You know, that is really bad, because I had worked at a mental hospital at one time as a secretary, typing up reports, and where people thought of something long enough and their mind did snap and they would do some very destructive things. And I thought, what if I did this and I did do this to him, and then I would be put in prison and my children wouldn't have anyone to take care of them, you know. So I thought, Barbara, there's something really wrong with you. You know, you better quit worrying about Charlie and find some help. So I finally got in contact with Al-Anon, and it was about, Siloam Springs is about 20 miles from where we live. So I went over there and talked with this lady's name that they had given to me, and she explained to me a little bit about alcoholism and wanted me to come to a meeting on a Friday night, and this was during the middle of the week. And she just seemed to have such compassion for an alcoholic, you know, and but she told me she understood how I felt, the despair, you know, and the loneliness and the frustration, and I thought, that's the first time anyone ever understood. I had been telling everybody in our community and my family about Charlie, you know. That's why you see me out on the roads at 3 a.m, and I'm looking for Charlie. Or if I wasn't looking for Charlie, I'm sitting out there making him wonder where I am, so he'll be upset about it and wonder what I'm doing out late at night. And it's cold and the frost on the windows, you know, and you're really showing him, and you come in and he's passed out and didn't know you were gone. So, anyway, you know, she understood my behavior where no one else did. Everybody always said, oh, Charlie's not that bad. And probably, you know, really, he wasn't that bad. I was crazy. You know, I was the one that the people probably couldn't understand. That because I was, you know, I'd be sitting in church, and I'd start faking a call so I could run home and catch him, whoever was there. I just knew he was bringing this gal down the corner up there at the house while I was at church. You know, just anything. And I was obsessed with alcohol. So this gal understood that my obsession. And I felt so comfortable to finally find someone. You know, well, I said I would come to this meeting on a Friday night. And she put me in contact with another lady that would meet me halfway there and bring me onto the meeting. Well, I got home, and between Wednesday and Friday, Charlie and I got in another argument, and he made me angry. Well, he kicked me in the seat of the pants. He thought I was stealing his money. I didn't write a deposit in the book or something, in the checkbook, and he thought I'd just taken it or something. I don't remember what it was. But anyway, I'd been over to show him something, and he kicked me in the seat of the pants. And now, he had a couple of times hit me in the face, and as I look back, I deserved it. I got pretty mouthy there a time or two. And I thought, but in the rear, that's degrading, you know. So I went to another lawyer. Went to my third lawyer. Of course, this little town that where these lawyers are, always about 1,100 population, there's only three lawyers, and I was about to run out. So I went to this lawyer and filed again. And I came home, and this time I had read enough in the Al-Anon to say, when you make a decision, stick to it. So I said, Charlie, you got to leave. You know, and they served him the papers, and this time I'm in it. So he moved out, and the little Al-Anon called me on Friday morning to see if I was going to go to the meeting with her that night. And I said, no, I don't need to go. I've taken care of my problem. You know, there's no need for me to go to Al-Anon now. I'm not living with an alcoholic, and this time I'm going through with it. So she just insisted. She just kept on and on and on, and I couldn't understand what kind of an organization this was, you know, that these people would be so persistent in getting a member there. Maybe, I thought, well, maybe it's a membership drive, you know. Remember in Sunday school when you could bring X many members, you got a little gold star by your name or something, you know. So I thought, well, maybe this is a membership drive, and she gets something, you know, and I'll go with her just to help her. So I went to this first meeting, and thank God I did. You know, and thank God it was the kind of a meeting that was the kind of meeting I needed. You know, they talked to me first. They went around the table and they explained to me about alcoholism. You know, what was happening to Charlie. You know, that it was a disease. That he didn't do this because he didn't love me, and that he didn't do it because he wanted to. That he had lost the power of choice, and I thought about it a little bit, and I thought, well, maybe I could try this for at least 6 months. You know, it was always my pattern, if you can't fix something, you know, if something's not working right, you fix it. If you can't fix it, you just discard it and go on. And, of course, I couldn't fix Charlie. And in my first marriage, I couldn't fix that, so I ran, you know. So it's always been my pattern to, if you don't like it, move on. And so I thought, maybe I should take my marriage vows a little more serious and try to stick this out. Some of these ladies were living in a lot worse situations than I was, and they seemed to be happy where they were. And if they could do it, then I'll try it. So I came home, and I called Charlie and told him that I thought I knew what the problem was and would he like to come back home. And, of course, he did. Because, like I said, this was a home that Charlie built. We commuted from Tulsa, and he built this home himself. And this was his land he'd bought and was going to retire on in his later years. So he was glad to come home. Well, I kept on going to meetings, and of course, I figured if I went to a few meetings and did what it said, I had that little ODAT, about that time the ODAT book, it had just come out, that was in 68, and the ODAT book had just come out, and I'd read that page, and it would say what reading for the day, I thought, well, I'm going to do this today, you know, this was like my script, I'm going to play this, I'm the angel in the family, and he's the you-know-what, and God's the director, and he's watching me, you know, and I'm going to play this little script out here this day. And it said to be kind or do just, you know, treat him nice or whatever. And I would do that. You know, I didn't mean it, but I did it. And I thought, well, I'll keep doing this because they said if I do this, the things are going to get better. And, you know, I kept doing that, and Charlie just kept on drinking. He just kept getting worse. And I thought, they're crazy. This program isn't working, you know. And I said, I'd tell him that. I said, I don't know why I need to keep doing these things because he isn't changing. And they said, Barbara, it's not to change Charlie, it's to change you. And I thought, but there really wasn't anything too much wrong there. I'm a kind, loving person, as long as I'm getting my way. That came out of my inventory, you know. I was always trying to do things to help Charlie on the farm. In fact, he said as soon as I left the farm and got a job that he started making a little money on the farm. Because I was always trying to help him, you know. I can remember one time I said something about, I'll feed the chickens for you today. That's before we had automatic feeders, and you had to scoop feed into the feeders. And he said, all right. He said, I've been putting two scoops in. So I go out to feed the chickens, and while I'm feeding, I thought, now, if I do a good job, probably tomorrow, then we'll go out and eat, you know, or something. In my mind, I'll do extra something nice, and then when I ask him to do something nice, he'll respond. So I go out, and I put in three scoops. So he wanted to feed the next day. So I came back in, and I told him what I'd done. He threw a fit. He said, I had just enough feed rationed out, so I don't have to call the feed company till another, so, and I'd screwed it up, you know. And then I thought, now here I've been so nice to him, and this is what he does. And as I looked at all the things I did nice for someone, there was always something attached to it, you know, because then I was going to want something from you later. And you better remember that I did this for you when I asked you to do something for me, because then I would be disappointed or whatever. And so in Al-Anon, I finally did learn how to, what we call love for free, you know, to love without any strings attached. I know I can just do the nicest things for somebody and think I'm doing it, you know, that I'm doing it for free. I just want to do this for you. But 6 months later, when something comes up, I'll remember that I did that for you and you didn't return that, you know, and I found out, well, Barbara, you really didn't do that for free. So I feel today that most of my good deeds, if they're deeds, and the feelings I have of people are for free. I don't have to have anything back. When Charlie finally started going to AA, I thought, now, you know, things ought to get better. You know, he's got a program now like mine, and he'll work these steps like me, and he'll start making amends to me. And I remember coming back from the meeting when of course, it's about a 30-minute drive to our meetings, and we usually fought all the way up and fought all the way back. We never talked about alcoholism. You never said the word alcoholic. You know, Charlie wasn't, we just didn't talk about that. I might have called him a drunk, but you didn't talk about the word alcoholism. And we would talk about people at the meeting or whatever, but we just kind of talked around this other. And I remember one night we were coming home, and I thought, well, I'll make some amends to Charlie, you know. And I said, Charlie, I want to apologize for a lot of things I did, you know, while you were drinking. Because I did a lot of things just to provoke him, because I knew that this would make him mad, and he'd already made me mad. In fact, I figure if you could do something ahead, stay ahead of him. You know, then you don't feel sorry for yourself when you're getting even, you know. So I got even, and I did things that were worse than Charlie did, because an alcoholic is sick, and he's doing these things when he's drunk, and I did them sober. You know, I did them out of revenge. And so I told him, I said, you know, I'm sorry for a lot of the things I said and did, you know, during those few years that you drank, and I wanted to apologize. And I thought, now, I'll wait for him to tell him I'm sorry. He was sorry, too, and he said, you damn well should be. So, you know, you never get back what you expect. But, you know, and we're talking about some of these things. Of course, we in Al-Anon, we work the steps, and we have to make our amends. And our life did getting better. It wasn't easy. Things were mighty cool around our house for several years. You know, we just didn't know how to talk to each other. We were both trying to change, and it's not easy to change. You know, like I said, I have these traits, and I see today that this is a trait that was in me, I guess from the day I was born, to take care of and fix, you know. And I don't know if maybe that's a motherly instinct that we're born with. That's why we have this urge to take care of our young, just like the mother bird takes care of the birds in her nest, and the mama cow stays with her calf. And this is an urge that we have. And it's not natural for me to leave things alone, you know, to live and let live. So I was fighting against a natural urge, you know, to want to fix Charlie. There were days when I could see he was depressed, and I'd want to say something nice to him. When I did, he'd get angry, you know, and this, you know how they are. You know, they don't want you to talk to them. And I know when he had a heart attack, I was just all over him, watching him every minute, you know, wanting to make sure he did it. Every day I'd come home and say, what'd you eat for lunch? Because he was supposed to watch what he ate, you know. And finally one day he said, well, what'd you have for lunch? And I thought, you know, I need to quit trying to take care of him, you know. God can do this. And it's awfully hard. It was awfully hard for me to turn over things to God, because I knew that God was powerful, and I knew that he could take care of these things, but I just... It wasn't natural for me to do these things. I know that when they said to admit that I was powerless, and yet I knew there were certain things I could do and get certain reactions, so that right there wasn't really true. Yeah. But it was just a tough battle for me. Every step I took in this program was surrender, and it's not easy to surrender. I remember my sponsor told me, she says, Barbara, the only way you ever win is to give up. And I thought, you know, that was what I had to do, was to give up. Every step I took, I had to give up a little bit more of my self-will. And it wasn't easy. I didn't like it. It was like, sometimes I've decided I was going to change my hairstyle, and I wanted to part it on this other side. And I would try to part my hair, and it would want to flop back, because for so many years it had been this way. And I don't know if any of you ever tried that. Your hair hurts. Your head hurts right there where, you know, it's been used to laying a certain way, and it does hurt. And you just work at it and work at it and work at it, and finally you get it trained to do this new way that you want it to be, and it doesn't, your head doesn't hurt anymore. And that was sort of like me trying to work these steps, you know, and to do what I needed to do in my own home. You know, I could do it in the meetings pretty easy, but boy, it was sure hard to do it at home. I remember one time we were going to the meeting, and I asked Charlie, "Do you want me to get your coat?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, he said, "Get my brown coat." Well, Charlie always lets me buy all of his clothes, and I knew I had not bought him a brown coat. I said, "You mean your green coat?" And he says, "No, my brown coat." And I thought, that coat's not brown. And I thought, well, what? Now, back in the past, I would have gotten something brown, something green, and proved to him that that coat was green. But it just occurred to me that Charlie sees things different than I do. You know? And I was taking away that person's right to see something the way he wanted to see it. And I was always frustrated trying to convince someone to see things the way I saw them. And I thought, I'm going to give him back the right to see and be and think the way he wants to think and feel. Because men and women just do think and feel different. And, of course, Charlie and I are different, extremely different. So I got a lot of peace when I did this and a lot more freedom. And of course, I'd been an owl on quite a while when that dawned on me. The light goes on. You know, you'll be doing something, and all of a sudden the light goes on. You think, oh, that's what they mean. And I know I could always show compassion to a new Al-Anon that came in the meeting. You know, and some of us come in there pretty... I was a very smart alecky type. Anything you said to me, you know, I had some smart reply, you know. And I remember they would say, look at the birds. Be grateful for the birds and notice the roses. And I thought, oh, you know, what? You know, and be grateful your children are well. And I thought, they ought to be. I'm taking care of them, you know. Or bloom where you're planted. You know, oh, I would always say, bloom where you're planted. I listen, too much manure kills plants, you know. And anything that they would try to say, I would come back, and if I didn't say it verbally, I said it in my mind, you know. And I remember this one lady, Charlie had was sober for some time then, and I still wasn't satisfied with his progress. And so I made some remarks about it. And she said, Barbara, can't you just be grateful he's sober? And I told her, I said, well, yeah, you can say that. Of course, they'd had a lot of years of sobriety, and she had a lot of the material things that I thought that I should have, you know. And I said, well, yeah, you've already got this, that. And besides, her husband had run a liquor store where Charlie always bought his booze. I said, besides that, we bought half that house that you're living in, you know. And, you know, I just wasn't very nice. But I thought about how, you know, they loved me in spite of me. And they didn't criticize or condemn me for being this way. And I thought of that one night at a meeting and how this little gal was acting, and I could see me, you know, and I thought, now when I go home, and if Charlie says something like this, I react, you know, and I don't even give my own family the right to feel bad or to say what they want to say or how they feel, you know, without reacting. And I thought, why, I'm going to have to start trying to apply this in my own home. And things even started getting better again. Not just for Charlie, but for me. You know, I found out that all this changing that I was doing didn't necessarily help Charlie. I'm sure it did in the long run. But it sure did help me because I was beginning to feel a lot better. I was a nicer person to be around. But Charlie got into AA, and we finally kind of got leveled off, and we got active in service, and our lives were going along pretty good. And I was, you know, every year of sobriety and every year of in my own program, you know, I just keep thinking, it just can't get any better. And, you know, you look back, and by golly, every year it gets better. And so... we have a daughter between us, and she was 13 years old, and she began to talk to me about some drinking that she was doing at some parties that neighbors would have, and she'd be over there and taste their alcohol. Of course, we didn't have it in our home. Charlie had already been sober 10 years. And immediately, my antenna goes up, you know, I'm hearing some things, you know, how she says and how she could drink, and I said, oh, Charlotte, honey, don't touch that stuff. I said, that were not sure, but they feel pretty sure that alcoholism can be hereditary. And I said, you could start the compulsion to drink at 13. And I don't know if I could watch another person die from alcoholism. And she said, oh, if I ever got as bad as Daddy, I'd quit. Of course, she never had really, I don't think she could even remember her father's drink, but she has heard the tapes, you know, and she's heard his story. And she's heard other alcoholic stories because we carried her around a lot of meetings with us and to conventions and things. So by the time she was 14, she was really getting some behavior problems. And I was beginning to check and find some evidence of some alcohol and other drugs and things in her room. And I'd read this article by Carol Burnett that said, if there's any suspicion, start checking. And I did, and I found it, and I panicked. And I quit my job. I've got to stay home and watch this child. This is my baby, you know, and I've got to, I'll just have to stay there and watch her and guard her. I can keep her from it, you know. And I caught myself doing the very same thing. You know, I was getting to be a screwball, and she was rebelling to me, you know, because of this constant observing I was doing with her. And I could see the us pulling apart. So I finally realized, you know, I was going to have to stop this. So one morning I took her down to catch the bus, and I said, Charlotte, I need to apologize for the way I've been acting. You know, I said, I guess there's just some things you're going to have to do, and I'm going to have to set you free to do it. I said, I don't know, you know, what's in store for you, but I'm going to have to set you free to try it. I said, maybe there's some things you need to learn so that you can help somebody else down the road like your dad did. I know my sponsor always told me that God does not do nor allow to be done what you wouldn't do yourself if you knew the end results. And so I don't know the end results, so I've got to turn these people loose to do what they need to do. And she, I could tell she was really relieved, and I was too, and our relationship just got so much better, and things were going real good. That was in about April, and in May, school was out, and the last of May and June, she ran off, and she was gone for a week. And, you know, when something happens to us that we don't like, just like I did in the old days, I had to have blamed somebody, and this time I blamed God, you know. Of course, I always believed in God, and I had a hard time turning things over to him because I'd pray to God, but I prayed for God, not for God's will, but for him to prove my will, you know. And so at this time, you know, I had been real active in Al-Anon. A lot of times I did things in Al-Anon I didn't want to do. Became active in service and did traveling that I didn't like to do. And I thought, now I've done all this for you, God, and this is what I get, you know. And I was so angry and scared, and then sanity would come back, and I, you know, I'd say, no, you know, I know God, you know, God is wherever my daughter is, and it's going to be all right. And I would get a little peace, you know, and then all of a sudden you would get the despair again, you know. And finally, after a week, the police department in Tulsa had found her and brought her back to us, and she was made a ward of the state. And she's just sort of been in and out of things since then. And she's a fantastic person. She's got that old alcoholic personality. She can just con you, you know. And she cons these social workers and all these people. And she's a lady. She's 16. Of course, when she was 14, she looked like she was 18. And here she's 16, looks like she's about 20. And she's got a lot of enthusiasm. She's got a lot of my self-will. Of course, I wanted to blame her daddy. You know, when this happened, I thought if he'd just... Charlie was always... He loved this child, you know, so much. And I thought if he'd just been more strict with her when she was younger, I felt like, you know, that he hadn't been, that she might not have been this way. You know, you want to blame someone. And thank God we both had a program so that we could handle this together. You know, we were in agreement on any decision with this child. Today, of course, she's been in and out of some foster home, and she was home a year with us, and it was great. You know, that year she came back with us, I said, if it took that week of this hell that I went through, not knowing where she was, it was worth it to have the relationship we have now. And but then she decided it was last October, she decided she wanted to run again. And you can just, I could almost see it like I did with the alcoholic. I start seeing the behavior change, you know, and there's things she wants to do, and she knows she can't do them at home, and she doesn't want to do them at home. And so it's just to run and do the things she wants to do. So today she's locked up, where there's a lot of bars and high fences, and I get to go and visit her 2 hours on Sunday, and they stand there and watch you while you visit. And finally, after 4 weeks, she got to come out for 2 hours. And she, when she walked out the gate, she says, "Oh, I finally got out." You know, and she's taking it all, you know, like she knows, well, she's misbehaved, you know. And, of course, in our state, they've told her, you know, that you've got to have a guardian until you're 17 and a half years old. And either you live with your parents or we appoint one. And because she is a ward of the state, they just jump right in there and intervene. And Charlie used to warn her, you know, when she was having trouble. He said, "Charlotte, someday you're going to get someplace where I can't even interfere with you. And you'll be out of my hands." And that's where she is. And, you know, when I came into Al-Anon, I thought, this is to help me to cope with alcoholism with my husband. And there again, I didn't know what God had in mind for me. You know, I didn't know what he was getting me ready for. And I still know there's a lot more things in life, you know. They didn't promise me that when I came down on that I wouldn't have any problems. And I don't know where I got that idea, you know. That when I got so angry with God, you know, I said, "Look what I've been doing, and you do this to me." And it's like he said, "Look, Barbara, I didn't promise you that it was going to be a bed of roses, but I'll be here to hold your hand when it's happening." And, you know, and when I knew that he was there with me, I would get this peace, you know, and know it was going to be okay. So I know that life is not going to be a bed of roses, because there's a lot of things happening out here. There's a lot of things happening in the people's lives that I love, you know, and it hurts me to see this sometimes. But for me and in my life today, you know, I'm okay. You know, I have something today that I would never have had my life not been affected by alcoholism. I had the 12-step program. You know, I always believed, you know, I heard the Ten Commandments, all those thou shalt nots. And you just don't tell me thou shalt not, because I got to try it. You know, the sign says wet paint. Now, I don't know how long it's been there. It might not be wet. You try it to see. And I tried some of those thou shalt nots, and, you know, they weren't bad. I kind of enjoyed some of them. But in this program, they gave me some positive things to do. And then they told me what the results of that would be, you know, having had a spiritual awakening. And today I feel different. You know, I'm okay. I can accept what is. I used to think, if I accept this situation, that's what they told me now, "Barbara, you're just going to have to accept." And I said, "I can't. I cannot live this way the rest of my life with him like this." He said, "Barbara, what makes you think you got to live like this the rest of your life? You just have to accept it today." And so when I know that, I can accept what is today, because it's not going to be this way. Life is full of changes, you know, and God will give me the strength to handle whatever happens, providing I keep myself on the right course. There's three areas of my life, my home, and Al-Anon, and my job, and those are the three things that I have to kind of work toward. Every once in a while, if I keep Al-Anon straight, and that's my first priority, and we talked about that this morning, if that's my first priority, everything else falls in line. But every once in a while, I get a little too tired, or I get a little bit wrapped up in my job, or I want to do something a little bit more wrapped up in the family situation, just want to start skipping some meetings or whatever. And somehow or other, my life isn't comfortable as it should be. But I find as long as I keep Al-Anon first, and, you know, it's not just reading the literature and studying at home and doing what I know I need to do, but it's putting into action what I know, and that's to go to meetings. And, oh, sometimes you get so tired, you just don't want to make your home group meetings. And I've made a commitment. You know, love is a commitment. You can say you love me, but, you know, a lot of times we can say I love Al-Anon, you know, because it saved my life. But I can't sit home and say I love Al-Anon. I've got to act on this. I have to make this commitment and then act on it. I go to my meetings twice a week in Siloam Springs, and there for a while we'd go to other meetings in our area. We were going every night, and we finally have slowed down, and physically we just couldn't keep up. But I try to always make my home group meetings. You know, that's like saying, "See, God, I really am grateful, you know. I'm still on your side, you know." And today I can say, you know, that I'm grateful that I'm married to an alcoholic. I'm not grateful that Charlie had to be an alcoholic, but I'm grateful that I'm married to one. Because it brought me 12 steps to live by that I would never have gotten by drinking, because I tried to drink, and two drinks and I'm asleep, you know. And it just, if alcohol had done for me what it did for the alcoholic, I'm sure I would be drinking. But, you know, and when I would get angry at Charlie and I'd take two drinks, I'd go to sleep, and then I couldn't fight. You know, so you don't take drinks, and you don't. And I went to the doctor, and he gave me some little pills that made me feel, that was supposed to make me feel better, and they just made me kind of draggy, you know, and I couldn't fight, you know. And you got to be on your toes. You got to stay alert to write down all these mileages and keep track of all this stuff, you know. So, you know, I think God looked down on me, and he said, that poor, squirrely thing, you know, she's never going to, she'll never make it to AA. And I've been active in the church, and but they never did. It was never a personal God, you know. It was somebody that was here, way off here, that you called on when you were in desperate need. And with my self-will, and you know, the alcoholic isn't the only one with self-will. With my self-will, I really didn't need him very often. I could just run into things. I'm just like a bull, you know. I just charge into things and do what I wanted to do, and I always managed to get what I wanted. If I couldn't want, I'd just change and go find something I could get, you know. And I had moments of happiness trying to achieve certain things that I wanted. It seemed like all the things I set out to get to make me happy never lasted very long. And the very things that I rebelled against, which were working the steps, you know, and going to meetings, the very things I didn't want to do, getting active in service, were the very things that have given me the strength and the peace of mind that I have today. So I've quit trying to pursue the things that are not for my spiritual growth, you know. And like I say, every day I keep thinking, you know, this is it. This is, they just can't get any better than this. But I know that it will, because it just keeps going. We just don't coast in Al-Anon. In fact, my sponsor told me one time, she said, you know, Barbara, you don't coast. The only way you coast is to go downhill, and you have to keep working at it. And there's sometimes you have to work harder than others. I'm so grateful to be here and to be invited. Y'all are just the nicest people to be around, and we're just really grateful that you brought us up here to be with you. Thank you.